Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Most of us have someone in our lives who can't seem to get enough excitement. They're always seeking adventure or thrills, rock climbing, cliff diving, skydiving. You know the type. This hour, we're going to try to find out why, for some people, thrill-seeking is the ultimate kind of fun, and maybe even a kind of necessity. But before we dig into that, Iowa Public Radio producer Rick Brewer is here with me to help us travel back in time.
Yeah, so back in 2013, Charity, you did a show on extreme sports, and you actually went skydiving, and you brought a recorder to document the experience. And at this point in the story, you'd gone through all the procedures, and then you're just sitting waiting for your plane.
I think I'm ready. It doesn't seem like a very sensible thing to do, but seeing other people land safely is reassuring. I'm not scared, but I would say that I do feel a little anxious, a little queasy. It's not something that is on my so-called bucket list. I never thought I need to do this before I die, but when presented with an opportunity to do it, it's a pretty exciting thing.
Have you ever been a thrill seeker, Charity?
I do not consider myself to be a thrill seeker, but I do consider myself to be an adrenaline junkie. I am a performer. I love to perform. I host a live radio show every day, and things could go very badly on the air, and I could be left holding the bag at any time and have been on many occasions, and I thrive in that kind of environment. So I do think I'm a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. As far as physical risk-taking, I like to ride my bike down hills fast, but I don't like to do anything that really honestly makes me feel like I could get hurt.
And here is how you described the moment right before you jumped. Elliot Kelly was the professional skydiver you were strapped to for the jump.
Then there I am at that moment when I suppose I could still back out. In fact, my brain is screaming at me to turn back, but I obediently scoot on my knees toward the door and hold the bar above my head. I let go, lean back against my instructor. Elliot Kelly starts to rock us back and forth. One, two, and on three, we fall forward into nothing.
And then you said at the end of this experience that you would not do it again. Why is that?
I really am glad that I did it. I feel like I proved something about myself by doing it. I feel courageous because I did that. And there were parts of it that I really, really loved. I loved once the parachute had opened up, it was absolutely silent and we just floated down over the Iowa countryside and I just sort of gazed and took in all of that beauty. I loved that part. The part that a lot of people talk about loving, the free fall, I hated that part. I really hated that part. And like I said, I feel like I proved something about myself by doing it, but it's not the kind of thrill that I want to seek out again and again.
And it's funny that you say that because when I took to the streets of Iowa City recently, I asked people about jumping out of a plane and most people said, never in a million years. And turns out that risk comes in a lot of different forms.
My life is a thrill. Let me think. I got a lot of crazy stuff happening to me.
I guess when I moved here when I was 17, so yeah, moving to Iowa City, it was a pretty big step.
I don't really take that many risks. I really like organization and structure, so risks don't really kind of fit into my lifestyle or life choices, I guess.
I came from all these small towns and I was not used to the big city. To a lot of people, this is not a great big city, but in 1990, it's me, yeah.
Well, one time, my homie came to my house. He was like, "Nut, I got this lick, man, we can go hit." So, I go with the guy, go to this house. So, it's a safe sitting in the yard. So, I'm like, all right, man, little lick, you know what I'm saying? Got a little safe, got guns. Okay, so we snatch up this big old safe out this person's yard. They had already got it out the house, though. So, anyway, We pick up this big old safe, big old heavy safe, man. It probably around about 80 pounds, man. It was a long time ago. This was years ago. Man, bro, we picked up this big old safe, put it in the back of the car, and we stole somebody's safe. We had a lot of money.
I met some college friends. They were from Hawaii and stuff, and they kind of like took me under their wing, and we all went on summer vacation, you know, down in Mexico. And it was one of those things where I wasn't physically in the water to see how deep it was. They're like, jump, jump. And I was like, have y'all done it before? And they're like, no, we haven't. And my redneck crazy side just took my hat off and jumped off. And I mean, the whole time falling down, I was praying, please let this be deep enough. Don't let me land on a rock. And I didn't. And it was very fun. I'd do it again probably a couple of times, but not much more than that.
The best things are scary. I love doing everything because it's scary. That means that you don't feel it. If it doesn't hurt, you're not doing it right. And life hurts all the time. Risk, what is it? Fear is a good motivator to do things you probably would never do before. Gets good results and bad, but then you learn from it and you do something fun.
This hour, we're talking about risk-taking, thrill-seeking, why some people can't seem to get enough of it, why others want to avoid it at all costs, and we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about your experiences, the kind of thrills you seek out, or maybe things like that have evolved over time in your life. Join us with your story, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my first guest this hour may not be the type of person who comes to mind when you imagine a thrill seeker. And yet, she recently decided to jump out of a plane. Rekha Basu is a nationally syndicated columnist and writes, of course, for the Des Moines Register. She's the author of the book Finding Her Voice. Rekha, hello.
Hi, Charity. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And you recently wrote about your experience skydiving. It was very similar to my experience.
I thought that too when I was listening to you. A lot of similarities.
Yeah, so you did a tandem skydive with an instructor basically harnessed to your back, right?
Exactly.
Why did you decide to do that?
It's a good question you ask. I did it because my boyfriend suggested it. And he, I thought, had done it before. Actually, he hadn't. He's very good friends with the person who manages the place where you do it in Winterset. And he just thought it would be a fun thing to do. And quite frankly, I think my ignorance carried me without much concern up to the point where I started telling friends I was doing it. And then they said, you're out of your mind, not in a million years. You'll die. You'll be dismembered. You know, terrible things will happen to you. Don't do it. And some of them really tried vigorously to talk me out of it. And then I think what happened is a sense of defiance kicked in, you know, and that's where my risk taking sort of gets confused with, you know, with
rebellion,
other stuff.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Like nobody's going to tell me what I can or can't do, except my kids. Because, you know, once you have kids, you kind of worry about whether you're being irresponsible by subjecting them to the possibility of being orphaned or motherless. I wanted them to endorse it. That was the only thing that really mattered, was I wanted them to be on board with it because I was afraid. I really did think, you know, what if I do die after I started hearing all these people? And then I heard about this one skydiving flight that went down in Hawaii and 11 people were killed and all of that stuff got inside my head. So after I had already made up my mind to do it without doing much research into it, I then started to like backtrack a little bit and get nervous.
So you actually called your oldest son, right?
To
ask him what he thought. And why did you pick him?
Well, so I have two sons. And the first one, the younger one who I called first, is actually, I would say, more of a risk taker in his own life. The older one is much more responsible. But the younger son didn't jump on board with great affirmation. He just said, it sounds like you're having a midlife crisis. And my response, as I wrote in the piece, is he was being generous because I'm well past midlife. But you know, as it got closer and all of these voices of different people were in my head, like my late mother-in-law, who would not get into a plane if her life depended on it. You know, I was thinking, and here I am getting ready to jump out of one. Is this crazy? So I called my son, Raj, who, you know, I thought I had to clear it with him. And his response was really not what I expected, because he is considered the only responsible member of our family. And he was the one who tried to advise us, like, not to pick up and move to Florida on a lark when we had been living in Iowa for 10 years. And it turned out that he was quite right. We didn't like it so much.
Right,
we
came back. You did it anyway. Right,
we did it anyway. There's that sense of defiance, right? And he said, you know, he said, it's something that I've never done, but I would love to do. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And then Raj being Raj, he started to recite statistics about skydiving deaths compared to car deaths on highways and told me that I would be much safer skydiving, so I should not live to regret the fact that I didn't do it. So that sealed it for me. As long as I got the clearance from my kids, then I felt that, you know, if I did die in mid-flight, it would be on them, on their conscience, not on mine.
But if he had said, Mom, I really don't think you should do this, what would you have done?
It is possible. I'm not sure, Charity, is the answer. It would have been 50-50 at that point. I may have backed out. I may actually have backed out. I wasn't, I'm not sure what I would have done.
So
but
when,
I needed him to say yes.
Yeah.
Maybe I would have tried to twist his arm and tell him that it wasn't so risky. Yes.
Like, you know what? Now I'm going to do my research and I'm going to make the case for you.
Exactly.
So, you're up there in the plane.
Yes.
And there is that moment at the door of the plane when it's time to fall into space. What was going through your mind at that moment?
So at that point, I was really trusting my tandem partner, you know, the instructor. And I just thought, I'm in good hands. He's been doing this for 30 years. He seemed very competent. He said he had never lost anyone yet. But I must tell you that before I got to that point, and I don't know if you had to sit through this too, there's this videotape that you have to watch in the hangar. And that really freaked me out, because there's this guy going on about death and horrible things can happen to you, and they do happen, and you need to know this, and we won't be responsible if it happens. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I thought this was going to be a training video. But basically, he's telling me I'm signing away my rights to life by taking this risk. Then I talked to the tandem person, and he was good. And as we were, I mean, I was just sort of breathless. You know that feeling
well,
as you approach the door.
We're going to leave there on a cliffhanger, quite literally, and take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Right now I'm talking with Rekha Basu. She is a nationally syndicated columnist. And of course, you read her in the Des Moines Register and the author of the book Finding Her Voice. This hour, we're talking about risk-taking, thrill-seeking behavior, and why so many people are drawn to it. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about thrill-seeking, risk-taking behavior. There are so many things that we can do these days in the name of fun that some people think are unthinkable, like jumping out of an airplane, like going on a zip line, or cliff diving, rock climbing, mountain climbing, all kinds of different adventures that people seek out in the name of fun that seem a little too risky to a lot of us. We'll dive into the psychology of that kind of behavior in just a few minutes. But with me right now is Rekha Basu. She is a nationally syndicated columnist and writes for the Des Moines Register, the author of the book Finding Her Voice. And recently she wrote about her skydiving experience. And just before the break, Rekha, I had you at the door of the airplane.
On the precipice,
right,
dangling precariously. Exactly.
So tell me more about what you were thinking at that moment.
Well, I mean, the sound of the sort of the wings, the choppers and the propellers, rather, and the sound of the air gushing was terrifying. And I was just thinking, okay, I'm in the hands of this really good trainer and everything is going to be fine. But right after that, when I jumped, oh, my God. You know the feeling, Charity. It was like nothing I have ever experienced before. It was utterly terrifying because you're dropping, 7,000 feet in 50 seconds. So the rush of the wind and this feeling of being completely out of control, it's both things. It's everything. And I don't remember seeing anything. I don't remember, you know, really feeling anything. I just remember feeling like this out-of-body experience of intensity. Is that how you remember it, too?
I honestly, my main feeling during that time was that I couldn't breathe because the air was rushing at me so hard and so fast, and I knew I was doing the right thing with my body, but I felt like I couldn't draw a breath.
And then I kept telling myself, but you are breathing.
You're still here.
Clearly, you're still breathing. So that was I did not like that sensation. And I know that that sense of free fall is something that a lot of people really love. And I think that if you do it repeatedly, obviously you get past.
You probably come to love it.
Yeah, fear.
I think that's right. I mean, I just kept telling myself, okay, this is just 60 seconds, 50 seconds. I can get through this, and then the next part is going to be great. And as you said, it was. I mean, then it was this beautiful feeling of freedom of just sailing around, which I had done parasailing once, and it was similar to that, just gliding with this parachute over your head and being able to look out, and the feeling of just a real feeling of bodily freedom.
Yeah.
And also, you know, psychological freedom.
So when you got done, did you think, I would like to do that again?
Not immediately, but I think I probably at some point would like to do something like that again. Certainly parasailing. As you said, I could do without that free fall piece of it. But maybe if I did it a couple of times, you know, I'd be more comfortable with it. You know, I'm not a person who does a lot of athletic exercise. I do a little bit of yoga here and there. But my risk-taking, because that's your topic today, comes in very different forms. It comes in going into, like, a war zone and being an intrepid reporter. Or it comes in moving to Iowa without my family to take a job with the Des Moines Register. Things like that turn me on. But I'd never really thought of intense risk-taking in that physical kind of a way before.
Well, and I think as a columnist, I mean, you are a risk-taker with every column that you write. This is one of the least controversial columns you've written
life. This is the one you invited me to talk about.
So, I mean, you are often putting opinions out there, and they are not always welcomed by all of your readers. I know that you've gotten, I mean, some very scary responses over the years. You're always putting yourself on the line. So you really strike me as a person who is a risk taker through and through, just maybe not a physical risk taker.
Yes, in that sense, absolutely. And I'm also an explorer. I love to go to different countries, and I love to, you know, go on tiger safaris or whatever. I mean, I just love to explore and experience new things. It's just that this kind of experience was not one that had been on my radar, although, you know, you have dreams of flying and things. But, yeah, I wonder, and I'm interested to hear from your guest about whether he equates this kind of thrill-seeking with the other kind that we're talking about.
Yeah, we will find out more about that. But I have one more question for you before I let you go.
Yeah.
Does the fact that you were able to do this, in spite of all those people telling you you shouldn't do it, the fears that got planted in your brain, and some of the very reasonable fears that also came there.
Yeah, somebody
on their
passed
own.
Out the day before on one of these.
Wow. So how does it make you feel about yourself that you pushed through and you did it?
It actually makes me feel really good about that. And it also made me feel like I need to trust my own instincts better and not start second-guessing my decisions when other people start to question them, you know, which is something that can happen with column writing, too. There was a period, and you referred to this before, where I was getting so much hate mail earlier on that I somehow subconsciously started shifting to topics which were less controversial. And then it was like pablum, and I wasn't getting any mail, good or bad. And I thought, what's the point of having this job? I'm supposed to take risks. I'm supposed to take strong positions. And I realized it was like I was letting those nasty letter writers get inside my head. And you can't. You have to ply forward and take risks for your profession, for your personal life, and for your recreational life. So I felt very good about learning that lesson.
Well, Reka, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's been really fun, Charity.
Reka Basu, she is a nationally syndicated columnist and writes for the Des Moines Register. She's the author of the book Finding Her Voice and recently jumped out of an airplane in a tandem skydive. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on risk-taking, the kinds of risks, the kinds of thrills you seek out, 866-780-9100. And my next guest is Tracy Cooper. And Tracy Cooper is a thrill-seeker. He also studies thrill-seeking behavior. He's a professor of liberal arts at Baker University in Baldwin, Kansas, and the author of the book Thrill, The High Sensation-Seeking, Highly Sensitive Person. Hello, Tracy.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
And
absolutely.
I want to start with kind of a definition, the high sensation seeking, highly sensitive person. You define yourself as a highly sensitive person. You've written a lot about how that shapes you and how people who are this kind of person can shape their lives to take advantage of that and not let it be a liability for them. But define it for me. What is a highly sensitive person in this definition?
Yeah. So defining a highly sensitive person is a person who has the personality trait sensory processing sensitivity. And that is a stable personality trait that's neither good nor bad, but is neutral and is defined by four key aspects. And sensation seeking also is four key aspects. So the four key aspects of sensory processing sensitivity are, first, depth of processing of all experience. So we tend to think and process things more elaborately than do other people. The second is overstimulation in certain circumstances. So in social circumstances and certain things, strong smell sometimes, bright lights. And each person is individual, so it's not the same for every highly sensitive person. One person may be affected by something and another one doesn't register at all. The third one is high empathy and emotional responsiveness. So we have a wider possible range of emotional responsiveness to a situation. So we may be feeling happy and sad, terrified all at the same time, whereas somebody else might just be feeling happy. We process a lot more in the way of emotions. Being highly empathic means that we tend to be able to enter the experiences of other people and feel what they're feeling to various degrees. And the last is sensitivity to subtle stimuli. So we tend to look at things like a visual scene for a longer period of time. We notice small clues that other people tend to not notice at all or to pass over. So all of that combined together creates someone that is sort of deeply empathic with other people, that notices things in the environment, that is kind of creative by innate nature, and someone that has to kind of manage their life to avoid too much overstimulation. And sometimes they need to withdraw to recharge at times. But in general, the highly sensitive person, I just wanted to add a few things, that it was thought that they were 15 to 20%. Now it's thought that we're almost 30% of the population. That exists along a continuum from people at the very high end who would have the most issues and people that are kind of along that sliding scale of sensitivity. So, and you need to have all of those four aspects to be considered really a highly sensitive person. But it is a personality trait. It's been studied pretty rigorously, including fMRI studies. It's been studied, so that's a way to look at the brain activity when you're presenting a scenario to a person. They can see which areas of the brain activate. And one of the key areas that activate are the mirror neuron areas in the front of the brain where we are that involve empathy. So there's been a lot of good science done on it. New science continues to be done all the time. So we're always progressing in our understanding of it.
So in describing a highly sensitive person, we might not think of a person with those traits as being someone who would want to seek out some of this thrill-seeking, these thrill-seeking experiences. I mean, they seem like sensory overload in a lot of cases. So connect the dots for me. What would lead a person who is, by your definition, highly sensitive to also want those sensations?
Yeah, well, by nature, I mean, all people are sensation seekers to one extent or another because we're all living in a world full of stimulation, right? And we're getting stimulation from each other in the social setting all the time. What causes someone to want to seek out stimulation? About 30% of highly sensitive people are also high in another trait called sensation seeking. And that's kind of what you're discussing here, but it's actually a personality trait called sensation seeking. So for those 30% of people that are higher in it, they possess one or more of these four key aspects of sensation seeking, which are, first, thrill and adventure seeking, which is what everybody identifies sensation seeking with. And that's exactly what you're talking about, skydiving, hang gliding, that kind of thing, physical thrills, seeking physical thrills. The second aspect would be novelty and new experience seeking, which your guest actually mentioned, liking to travel, enjoying traveling. And that absolutely is one of the four aspects of sensation seeking is novelty and new experience seeking. So they like to travel and see new things and have new experiences simply for the sake of doing it. The third aspect would be disinhibition. Your guest brought up the idea of facing fear through defiance. In a sense, that's really a disinhibition. That's just saying, this is something I might not want to do, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. This willingness to take risks, this willingness to step beyond normal boundaries, to have the experience itself. And then the fourth aspect would be a susceptibility for boredom. So people who are high in sensation seeking tend to bore easily. They tend to not like repetition. They tend to like short-term projects. And so if you cross the two, if you're a highly sensitive person and a high sensation seeker, you would think that's quite dichotomous, that one doesn't really follow with the other. But what happens is it's almost like being two people at once, because you have that kind of quiet person that says, hey, let's think about this risk before we take it. And you have the sensation seeker that says, let's go ahead and do this anyway. Whereas a person that is just a high sensation seeker might go ahead and take the risk because they don't have that cautionary aspect in their personality to kind of temper it down a little bit. So people who are sensation seekers they'll have those experiences. Whereas the highly sensitive person that is not a high sensation seeker would avoid it because they're going to spend a lot of time thinking, oh, there's too much risk involved in this and I don't really want to do it. And it's unpleasant and so forth. So it becomes unpleasant, then you don't want to do it.
I can imagine that there are some downsides, some pitfalls to this kind of personality. I mean, we heard during the voices earlier in the show, we heard from a number of different people who obviously seek risk in different ways. There are ways to seek risk that are self-destructive. I mean, there are people who are drawn to drugs because of the thrill-seeking kind of behavior, or drawn to crime because of thrill-seeking kind of behavior, or just have a hard time with life because they get bored so easily. I mean, tell me more about some of the dangers.
Right. Yeah. And I have a whole chapter in my book, Thrill, the High Sensation Seeking, Highly Sensitive Person, on risk taking and risky behaviors. And it is very well connected to, or very positively connected to, risky behaviors, and including criminal behaviors and including addictions, including alcoholism, because people, normal reality isn't enough for them. They need that little kick, that little thrill. And that comes through stimulation of what's called the pleasure pathway in the brain, or the dopamine pathway in the brain. So every time you do something that's kind of a little bit thrilling, you get a little hit of dopamine in the brain and you feel good and you want to do it again. So when they're doing something like alcohol, they get a good feeling from it. And then the problem is, kind of like drug use, the more you do it, the more it kind of becomes, the body gets used to it. And then you have to do something more in order to get that same kick. And so you can quickly become something like an alcoholic with no way to get out of it. And the same with drugs. A person that is low in sensation seeking might do one drug and they would stick to that one drug. But the high sensation seeker would have to try many drugs because they would always be looking for a novelty, a novel thrill. And it always has to top itself each time because they're looking for intensity of experience is what they're looking for. But person that is a highly sensitive person at the same time has a cautionary sort of ethic built into their personalities that will say, hey, let's think about this. Let's reflect on this a little bit, and so that's a very good quality to have as a high sensation seeker, that you have this kind of cautionary friend on your shoulder to say, no, let's not quite do that. Or to say, yeah, let's go ahead and do that. Sometimes you have to let the sensation seeker run, but not necessarily with risky behaviors, because there's always legal, financial, personal consequences to everything we do. And the person that's high in sensation seeking that, say, decides to commit a crime, even by, say, driving really fast, which is one of the things that sensation seekers will do, especially young males. So sensation seeking tends to peak in late adolescence. And so that's why you see a lot of young males that drive very fast. They tailgate. They'll pass people. They get their thrills inside of a vehicle in many other ways. But that's one of the things you'll see when you're on the road driving and you see a young male fly past you, he's probably a high sensation seeker. There's no way around it. But and it tends to peak in adolescence, late adolescence, and then decline over life. And then later in life, you tend to not seek out the same kind of physical thrills at the same level. So something may be thrilling for you, but it may not be the same sort of extreme thrill you might have wanted when you were much younger. But with risky behaviors, I mean, it could be sex with multiple partners, unprotected sex, or going to parties that are wild that might have, there may be drugs present, there may be people that you probably shouldn't be around. A lot of things can happen when you're a sensation seeker, because you have to control impulsivity. So the idea is that here's this experience that you feel like might be cool, might be fun to do, and you have this disinhibition, this aspect of the trait that says, let's go do this anyway. I don't really care. So it's kind of a devil-may-care attitude in a sense. And that's the real dangerous part of it, is the disinhibition, sort of low impulse control. If you can't control your impulses that say, let's go do this very dangerous or maybe illegal thing, then you have a real problem. And it takes a long time to be able to overcome that, if at all. And a lot of people that are in drug therapy, alcohol therapy, they're high sensation seekers that never really learned how to control it.
Interesting. Well, and we're going to have to take a short break here in just a moment, and we'll talk more about that. But it is something that I've observed often over time is I know a lot of runners and sometimes people who get involved in ultra marathons or extreme running sports. They seem to have addictive personalities in many ways, but that would be called a positive addiction. So it seems like there's a strong relationship there. Have you found that?
Yeah. Yeah, it can be a positive aspect of life, being a sensation seeker. If you can channel it in the right ways, it can be a fantastic thing because it leads you to explore possibilities in life. It leads you to be more creative. By nature, people who are sensation seekers are also divergent thinkers. So they tend to think in different ways. They tend to prefer things that are asymmetrical rather than symmetrical.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Tracy Cooper is a professor of liberal arts at Baker University in Baldwin, Kansas, and the author of the book Thrill, the High Sensation-Seeking, Highly Sensitive Person. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon. October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about thrill-seeking, risk-taking behavior, and why, for some people, it's the ultimate kind of fun or even a necessity of sorts. With me right now is Tracy Cooper. He is a professor of liberal arts at Baker University in Baldwin, Kansas, and the author of the book Thrill, the High Sensation-Seeking, Highly Sensitive Person. We also want to hear from you. What are your thoughts about this kind of thrill-seeking behavior? We'd love to hear about your experiences. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to go to the phones. Margaret is on the line in Moline, Illinois. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for calling. Tell me your story.
Well, since my husband died 2 years ago, we loved to travel. We lived overseas, but we were not thrill seekers. We didn't even do roller coasters. And so I have been traveling, and I went to the Balkans, and I was in Macedonia last month, and 4 of the 8 people, the ladies, all my age, and I'm just 73, said, let's go paragliding. And I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. But I did. And, you know, it was frightening when you're running to take the jump. But after you take the jump, it was almost spiritual, Charity. It's quiet, beautiful. You can hear the details from the ground, like the animals, the dogs barking, and, the sheep they making their noises. And I was up about half an hour, and I don't know if I'd do it again, but it was just incredibly, incredibly emotional, I would say. It was just beautiful. Oh. And I'm none of the things that your guest just described. I do not like to lose control.
So I'm curious, Margaret, I mean, it sounds like a really wonderful experience. How do you think about yourself now that you've done it? Did that change your idea of you a little bit?
I'm proud that I did it. I would do different things. I don't know if I would do skydiving, but I just feel it's one more thing I've done in my life that I can say I've done. And I think that's really important. I really felt it was a milestone for me.
Oh, Margaret, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Well, thank you. Enjoy your program. Bye-bye.
Bye. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Tracy, I want to dig into some of the positive things about having these personality traits as well, since we were focusing on some of the dangers or some of the pitfalls before. But before we do that, can you respond to Margaret's experience? I think a lot of people do seek out this kind of adventure, sometimes as a one-off kind of event or as a milestone or a passage between two different parts of their life. Tell me more about what people might be looking for in those moments.
Sure. Yeah. Just like your guest mentioned, that we seek out these experiences to have these one-off one-off chances in our life to do something that we might never do again. That doesn't make somebody necessarily a high sensation seeker, a novelty, a new experience seeker, and that can make you a sensation seeker, but not necessarily high in it, because the high sensation seeker would think that, hey, I want to go do this again right after landing on the ground, you know, and do it again and again, and then top each one of those experiences. Whereas somebody lower in sensation seeking might do it one time and say, ah, it was fun, but I might not want to do it again right now, and not come back to it. But the wonderful part about it is that she was able to have a growth experience from it. And that's a very positive aspect of sensation seeking. And as I was saying before the break, that creativity is one of the things that sensation seekers tend to be very high in, because we are divergent thinkers. We tend to think in a different way than do people that are lower in sensation seeking. We tend to look for connections that other people pass up. We tend to think about things in a different way as a divergent thinker. And that's really part and parcel of creativity, as much as curiosity is, and openness to new experiences. So particularly with combining that with the highly sensitive person, when you have both of those traits, I mean, you have a deep reflective person, you have an innately creative person as a sensation seeker, and then you have this kind of curiosity that's built into it implicitly, you have quite a powerful combination for a lot of positive actions in the world as a creative person, particularly if you can combine a really rational brain with that. If you can think very rationally and creatively, you really have the best of both worlds, and the sense that I'm going to go explore, I'm going to look at new ideas, I'm going to do something with them. I can be a very positive force in the world.
I'm curious about your story, Tracy. When did you discover the idea of this kind of personality type? Was it something that you were looking for because you are this kind of person and didn't quite understand it?
Oh, well, I grew up in small town Missouri, so, you know, not that far from Iowa. And as kids growing up in the 1970s, we were always on bicycles and racing and doing things that we probably shouldn't have been doing, but they were thrilling, you know. And so I knew that about myself, that I had wanted to have these experiences, but I also knew that I was cautious at times too and would think about it, and you know, more so than my friends around me that would think too much. And then when I got to be older, I was drag racing a lot. So I did a lot of drag racing as a late teen and hopped up Trans Am. And it was thrilling, completely thrilling, and, you know, more so than other things that I would do. But you always had to top it and do something more. So later in life, when I went back to school to get my PhD at 44, I had to do something for a dissertation. And so I got into doing something that was real personal for me, which was exploring myself in terms of career. So I studied highly sensitive people in career for my dissertation. And along the way, as a matter of doing that study and talking to many people that were highly sensitive, came across about a third of them that were high sensation seekers as well. And that bore itself out over time. And I came to understand that trait in myself after I realized that I was a highly sensitive person, decided that I wanted to study that more. And so I did that all post-dissertation, wrote a book, did a whole new study, and I've been studying it ever since. And that's how I got into it and made these realizations about myself. And I think it's crucial to spread these messages about learning who we are, being self-aware, so that we can learn to take advantage of the potentiality that's inherent in each one of the traits. And they're wonderful traits when they're combined together, sensitivity and sensation seeking. Like I said, you have a really powerful combination.
The kinds of activities we've been talking about seeking out, you know, the sort of vacation idea of thrill seeking, whether it's, you know, paying to go skydiving or paragliding or on a zip line, that kind of thing. That's the kind of thing that people can do, people of privilege can do when they travel or go on these adventures. But it's brief. It doesn't last very long. I mean, what does a one-off experience like that give you?
Well, for a high sensation seeker, it gives you a momentary boost. It gives you that little hit of dopamine in the brain, and you feel good, and you want to do it again. The problem is that if you don't have a lot of means to do these kind of things, you seek out other ways, and that can lead to risky behaviors that are less costly in a sense. But it can also lead to a good way of expressing the trait. And a trait is always, you know, a matter of genetic inheritance. You inherit certain genes, and there's one or more genes that are responsible for sensation seeking, and developed about 50 to 100,000 years ago in our evolutionary history. And they made people the kind of people who would go explore. You know, they were the explorers. They were the ones that had to see what was over the hill. They had to think about, how can we make something better? How can we do something better? Because they had this problem with boredom. And so they're always occupying themselves with something new, something innovative, something creative. But you can also seek out thrills and new novelty and new experience through each other, you know, through the social scene. And I think in another day, prior to people having as many means, I think they saw out their quota of thrill seeking or sensation seeking through, you know, socialization, through church meetings and things like that, where, you know, there's no way to get a better thrill than through each other, than through other people, you know, because we connect the most with other people. As much as we can have external thrills, it really is possible to have internal thrills as well. And there's no better thing to simulate that than other human beings that we relate to.
So in your research, how do you study these kinds of behaviors and how they affect us? How have you tried to break that down scientifically?
Yeah, so what you have to do is you have to interview a lot of people, and it's hard to catch sensation seekers because some of them will volunteer. They'll say yes to everything simply because, you know, they want the excitement of doing something new, and it's always prevalent. You can be guaranteed any group. Some of the people are going to be sensation seekers because they want that new experience. So to study them, you interview a lot of them. You start noting kind of themes and things they're talking about in commonality. And of course, you know something of the literature and something of how the trait developed and the research behind it. And then the more people you talk to, the more you kind of gain a body of knowledge about how it works and how it plays out in people's lives. So interaction of the genetic inheritance with the environment that people are in kind of determines how the trait is expressed at any given time. So people that are in certain environments, the trait may express in one way and another environment expresses in another way as it's needed. So the way that we study it is to talk to a lot of people until you reach a saturation point. And then you start looking at distilling it down into themes and then interpreting what those themes are. And so that's kind of the scientific process of doing semi-structured interviews, qualitative interviewing. You can also do things like surveys where you have a list of questions where you can ask people and measure their attitudes toward something that you want to know more about. And that's how the trait was originated by a psychologist named Marvin Zuckerman at the University of Delaware in the late 1960s, believe it or not. He delineated the trait through studying sensory deprivation. He noticed some people were antsy when they were put in a room with no noise or no stimulation. In fact, they would start talking to themselves or humming to themselves just to get some stimulation. And so he started looking at his friends that were around him and the kind of things they did and thinking about the kind of questions he could ask based on what his friends around him did, and developed the four key aspects of sensation seeking. But he also said that one doesn't need to be high in all four aspects to be considered a sensation seeker. You can be high in just one and really think of yourself as a sensation seeker. I think most people probably would identify with novelty and new experience seeking more than they would thrill and adventure seeking, though.
Let's go back to the phones. Mary is on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, when I started listening to the show, I was very excited. I was a thrill seeker, not as a small child, but as a teenager. I was the one who rode the wildest rides, who was dropped off in the cemetery in the middle of the night and didn't mind, and drag raced and did whatever I could to seek a thrill, a high. And then I got married and raised five children. And at 70, I'm now a widow. And I find myself once again in that thrill-seeking mode. I went to Niagara Falls and did the zip line, found it disappointing and rather boring, went to Las Vegas, went on the rides off the side of the stratosphere, found them relatively satisfying, but not too much. And then 3 weeks ago, my children gave me for my 70th birthday present skydiving. And I found it just slightly disappointing that it wasn't as thrilling. And now, after hearing that lady on your show, I want to try parasailing, paragliding.
So it just doesn't quite do it for you, huh, Mary?
Well, I tend to be a person who thinks through the consequences, and I don't go off, you know, half-cocked. I don't do that. But I do seek out exciting, adventurous things, and I'm always looking. As I'm older and I'm not raising children and I'm retired, I find myself back to looking for the thrill, looking for the next adventurous thing. You know, standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon was glorious to me. You know,
yeah.
That was so exciting to me. I don't know why, but I thought maybe they would have the entire thing fenced in.
So
I went out on that. Yes.
I'm curious about when you were raising kids, those years when you had to be a little more personally conservative about what you were doing. Can you think of how you channeled this kind of behavior in those years to still get the excitement?
Well, I was a single parent from the time my youngest child was about 5 months old.
Wow.
And I was a single parent until my youngest was like 22. So I remarried at a very late age. And I found raising five rambunctious, adventure-seeking children and trying to keep them halfway reined in was quite enough excitement.
Yeah.
Whenever I got a chance, I would drive really fast and, you know, things like that. But raising five children on my own was exhilarating as well.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experiences. And we just have a couple of minutes left. Tracy, I mean, Mary definitely ticks all the boxes for being the kind of thrill seeker we've been talking about this hour.
Yeah, absolutely. She seems to have been able to keep it going through her child-raising years, and that tends to be how it plays out. Sensation seekers tend to, actually, we tend to, she mentioned thrill seeking and doing things that were pretty risky, that we tend to assess the risk actually very accurately. More so than do low sensation seekers. They tend to overestimate the risk. High sensation seekers estimate the risk very accurately, but they're willing to have the experience anyway. So they're willing to take that risk. And that kind of plays out with what she was saying. But also that along the way, we tend to be, it doesn't go away throughout our lives. I mean, being 70 doesn't mean anything. You can still be a very active, vital person and still seek out sensation and novelty and new experience seeking and all of those kinds of things. And a moderate expression of the trait is really the best, because then you're not taking undue risk. You're able to really enjoy the potentiality and the growth aspect, but not take undue risks that are going to really possibly cause you some kind of harm.
You've written a lot about this kind of personality trait, but also you give advice on how to channel it in really positive ways. So with just about a minute and a half left, what is your advice for someone who is always looking for that risk, always looking for that thrill, but channeling that to really find meaning in life and make the most out of it?
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, being a divergent thinker and being someone that needs new stimulation all the time, you're going to probably experience a lot more growth in your life than with somebody that is not a sensation seeker, because you're always looking for that new stimulation, and you'll try unusual things. You'll study Eastern mysticism. You'll pursue an advanced graduate degree like I did, and you'll move towards things that other people wouldn't even think of doing, and just to have the experience. So the experience itself becomes autotelic. And in doing that, then you have to take care of yourself, and you have to practice good self-care, and you have to think, if you're not a highly sensitive person, you don't have that cautionary aspect to warn you, then you need to be more aware of the risk that you're taking and make sure you're not doing something at undue risk, but you're also utilizing sensation seeking for its full potentiality, which is, you know, propelled by curiosity. So if you can harness those things and you can kind of moderate it, then you can really enjoy a huge amount of benefit throughout your entire life. And you can really be a force in the world that is very, very positive. And, you know, you tend to be a firecracker out there in the world, somebody that, because you have novelty and you need novelty, you tend to try to inspire it in other people. And in that way, it's a very healthy expression.
Tracy Cooper, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Tracy Cooper teaches at Baker University in Baldwin, Kansas, and is the author of the book Thrill, the High Sensation-Seeking, Highly Sensitive Person. Talk of Iowa is produced by Rick Brewer, Dennis Reese, Caitlin Harrop, and Shirley Wong. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.